joining us today, right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we love to hear from you. We have like hundreds of thousands of people who are listening to our wonderful podcast right here on Progressive Radio Network. And we are on live every Tuesday, 10 to 11 a.m. And one of the wonderful things is then on PRN, the show is archived. We have a link to it also on our website at naturalnurse.com. And that's the best place to get in touch with us at Natural Nurse, all one word, naturalnurse.com, or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And we have classes going on every single day in all aspects of natural medicine. Today, I have a class that I'll be teaching, private classes, one on how to use homeopathy. That's a good thing to find out about right now and purchase all your materials as well as your homeopathic remedies if it's something you want to explore, because the regulations are becoming more and more invasive in terms of freedom to use and understand homeopathy. We have a class today also on the use of essential oils, sometimes called aromatherapy. And there is so much information going around which is incorrect about aromatherapy, and a lot of that is being put out by, you know, companies who sell those products. So if you go to naturalnurse.com, you can sign up for a free newsletter just by typing your email in the bottom left-hand corner. And then if you go to calendar, naturalnurse.com calendar, you'll see the many group classes. Group classes are a great way to get a phenomenal amount of information for a tiny, tiny fee, and in fact, a lot of times free. So you want to check that calendar. For instance, we have coming up online herbal manufacturing legal considerations. That is a live class. And that's, you know, you've been making some tinctures and extracts and putting little tea in bags and making maybe a skin salve with plants and herbs, and you're going, wow, this stuff works really well. You give it to your friends and relatives and they're loving it. And someone says to you, you know, maybe you should sell these on Etsy. Well, this is a warning. Take this class first, herbal manufacturing legal considerations. I have three clients this week alone who have gotten warning letters from doing just that and placing their products on Etsy. And there's lots of rules about doing that, lots of rules. So you really may want to find out what the rules are first, because should you get a warning letter, and that could be from the FDA or the FTC, saying, oh gee, I didn't know there were such rules, does not apply and does not stop you from, you know, in some cases, having your life quite ruined financially and on many other levels. So I truly suggest that you find out first. And this is a good, inexpensive way to do it. It's called Herbal Manufacturing Legal Considerations, coming up this very month. Then we have a wonderful course called Natural Nurse Herbal Certification. And this is a full course. I give it all the time, but this is the least expensive way to take it because it's a big group class. And so you can look at naturalnurse.com calendar and find that class, Natural Nurse Herbal Certification. This is a series of four classes given over 4 months, which if you sign up, you get the classes and you can attend live with me in real time. And we also have them sent to you after they are finished. And there's a lot of homework in that class. And many people who are already health professionals, such as nurses and doctors, who want to learn how to integrate natural medicine, and in particular herbal medicine, into their practice, take it, but it is open to anyone. It does have CE units and credits for nurses, nurse practitioners, registered dietitians, licensed massage therapists, and licensed acupuncturists, but you don't have to be one of those. Anyone can take the class. And what you get at the end is a certificate of attendance for 18 CE credits, because there is homework involved. You actually have to make a little herbal project and mail it to me. That's legal to do, right? Not sell it, just make it. It's legal to make it. It's just to sell it that gets to be an issue. So you learn how to do that. Then we have a free webinar coming up on iron, what you need to know about the strength mineral. For instance, you know, perhaps you don't know all the different kinds of iron. Do you need any extra iron? Do you know how to figure out the different supplements and which is best for you? What is the difference between heme and non-heme iron? What are the most comic metallic elements in the universe? So that's a great course, and it is free. So you can find out how to sign up for that on the website, naturalnurse.com calendar. We also have a class coming up called Career Paths in Natural Health. Perhaps you'd like to move into doing natural as part of your professional life. That's a specific class on all the different avenues that you can go down to make that happen for you. We have that as a group class, very, very reasonable. And then we also have that as a private class where we actually look at your own resume and send you down specific paths. One of those paths is becoming an RH. An RH is a registered herbalist. And by the way, you don't need any other degrees. There is a process to apply for RH, and it's not easy. It's a lot of work. It's only for people seriously, seriously involved in wanting to be a professional herbalist. So those are just some of the many things available to you at naturalnurse.com calendar. They're all listed there. Join the website if you'd like to get emails. Very rarely, I think I send out an email, I don't know, once every month or two. We do not, you know, promulgate a million emails to you, but it does keep you up with what's going on here. And of course, we're very busy with private sessions, both in terms of regulatory issues and people who want to know what natural remedies should they take for themselves and their family. So today we are so happy to have as our guest Dr. Vidisha Mohad. And I found Dr. Vidisha because I was reading scientific journals, which I read all the time, and I actually came across the fact that she was getting an award for a scientific research article that she did. And she is a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Mohad has performed her undergraduate studies at the University of Mumbai, India, followed by a master's in communication disorders. And she completed her PhD at the University of Wisconsin before joining the Harvard Medical School for a postdoctoral research fellowship. And so she is obviously an extremely serious scientist and serious researcher. Now, what brought me to her is this article that I read, which said, wow, somebody that brilliant is looking into how gut health, the microbiome, and other aspects of physiology are linked to health. Her current research focus is to understand the gut epithelial biology. So, of course, she knows all about that little word, leaky gut syndrome, on a much higher level, and the impact of the gut microbiome on gastrointestinal diseases such as IBD, Crohn's, and metabolic disorders. So thank you so much, Dr. Vidisha Mohad, for joining us today here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Hi, Ellen. Thank you for that kind introduction. It's such an honor to be here on your show. I'm very excited.
Well, we're great. We're very, very happy to have you. So let's go back in time. We have a nice amount of time in this show, so we don't have to rush through everything. I know you're very involved in gut dysbiosis research now, but how did you, growing up in India as a woman, become so interested in deeply pursuing science?
So that's a very interesting question, Ellen. So, you know, as a child, I mean, I didn't really know what I was going to do, especially in India. It's culturally very different. However, I had the passion. I wanted to learn more. And I think it was my high school chemistry class that really got me excited in learning of biology and science. You know, our whole, our world is made of like chemical elements and like the interface between chemistry and biology and how our human body works was just so intriguing to me and was exciting. And I wanted to learn more. I worked hard. I went to school, went to college, and I decided to come to the United States for further education because this is the place to be for excellence. And today I'm here at Harvard Medical School. I'm so grateful to be here.
Now, let me ask you this. Was there any kind of, I mean, are women supported in their pursuit of science on a cultural level in where you grew up?
So, you know, things have changed, but when I was growing up, there was...
Well, you're not that old, let's put it that way. Yeah. So you're just one generation up, but nonetheless.
You know, there are definitely, you know, limitations for women to pursue education, absolutely, because culturally, I can only talk about Indian culture, like women are expected to be at home and, you know, get married and raise a family, which is great. I mean, that's not nothing wrong with that, but that limits their opportunity to pursue education, right? So, yes.
So what about your parents? How was your father about this?
Oh, my God. I was very fortunate. My parents were very supportive, especially my mom. I had to, like, you know, talk my dad into letting me go to the U.S. and, you know, letting me study more. But he came around. I was very lucky to have very supportive parents, my cheerleaders all throughout my life. But that's not the case for all the girls in India. That I can tell you that for sure.
So that's really, you know, that was really a big step, because if you were part of a different family where they just put their foot down, I'm thinking of my mom. My mom is 92, mm-hmm. and she was invited, because she was a very talented singer, to be a performer at a very prestigious club in New York when she was young. She's 92 now. Her father put her foot down and he said, no daughter of mine is going up on a stage. Everyone in show business winds up being whatever he thought, an alcoholic and a drug addict and sexually abused. So he completely stopped her from a career that, you know, she really wanted to do. And I don't think she ever has forgiven him about that.
I can totally relate to that. I mean, it wasn't a piece of cake for me to convince my father, but, you know, I was so determined. Going to school requires money, right? I mean, he was kind enough to let me go to school in India, but when it was time to come to the United States, I think at that point he was kind of like had his foot down and he said, you know, I don't have the money to send you to the US. And at that point I was like, you know what, I will figure my way out. I don't have to take any money from you. And once I figured that out, he couldn't go back on his word. He had to let me go. So.
Well, I think it's wonderful that you pursued it. And in the end though, your parents really probably did recognize that you have a gift. Not everybody, and especially not every woman, wants to pursue such deep scientific research as you have done.
That's very kind of you, Ellen. Thank you.
Now, once you did, you know, get along and get through school as a young girl and get yourself, I mean, you studied in other places as well. Yeah. Besides, you studied also in Mumbai, which is a major city also. You know, that's not just nothing. Then you moved to the United States. Now you're really at perhaps the top school, Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital, where you're doing your work. That gives your voice so much power as you move forward in life.
It's, you know, I have seen women, like I have friends and, you know, with my experience being the connection with being in India, I have seen women need mentorship. They need mentorship to pursue. Everybody's talented, but you need a push. You need someone to look up to, like an inspiration, to pursue what, you know, their career goals are. And I think mentorship is very, very important. And in my spare time, I take, you know, whatever time I can to mentor some students back in India. And I have a bunch of undergraduate students here who are my mentees. So I really enjoy that. I think it's very important to guide young women to do science, to pursue whatever their ambition is. And it doesn't necessarily have to be science, but they need some sort of support to get ahead in life.
So who were your mentors?
So growing up, I think my high school teacher was, he had the biggest impact on me, I think. He was one of the teachers who really saw the passion that I had for, you know, doing something different. He was the initial inspiration. However, I don't know if you've heard of her, Indra Nooyi. She was the first female CEO of PepsiCo. She was from India. And she had shattered ceilings. You know, she was the first immigrant woman to be in the United States and, you know, running a big corporation. So I looked up to her and I wanted to do something what she did. So I think that's why I decided to come to the U.S. Because of her. Particularly in science, I think Rosalind Franklin, who was, you know, a part of the DNA discovery, and she was, I don't know if you know the story behind the discovery of the DNA. Her contribution was so crucial for the discovery, but she was not recognized for her contribution for the longest period of time. And in the most recent years, I think Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier, who got the Nobel Prize for discovering CRISPR-Cas9 for gene editing, I think just amazing women.
So, you know, you're going to be right up there with all those names because you're doing some really groundbreaking research. And when I'm looking at all these studies you have already published, targeting the gut to prevent sepsis from a cutaneous burn, insights into the role of collagen in vocal fold health and disease. You mentioned you had studied communication, a role for intestinal alkaline phosphatase in preventing liver fibrosis. Now, those may not mean a lot to some of our listeners, but it means a lot to me, because what it means is the work you are doing, you know, with my focus being natural medicine and holistic medicine, what you are doing in mainstream science very much supports what we're doing on an interventional level in what's called functional medicine. Mm-hmm. So that's the excitement for me.
I think, you know, functional medicine and traditional medicine, as you say, they're related. However, the way medicine has been run in the past, I don't know, 20 years, I think it needs to change a little, because we need to take into consideration what role our gut plays into all the biology and the disease biology specifically. So I think it's very important. And this is great what you're doing, you know, providing listeners with information, scientific information, evidence-based information, which is fantastic. You're a great resource for people. Yeah.
So now your research may also be used for the development of pharmaceuticals as well, I imagine.
Absolutely. So to give you a little bit of background, what we study in the lab is specifically we look at intestinal alkaline phosphatase. In layman's terms, it's an enzyme which our body produces, and it's like abundantly present in our body. And we study the microbiome. So intestinal...
Wait. Let's do a little defining.
Okay.
So what do you mean by the microbiome?
So microbiome, if you think about, if I have to give you an analogy, microbiome are all the organisms that live in your body and not necessarily the gut. We have a microbiome of our skin. We have microbiome in our larynx. We have microbiome in our genital organs. They're everywhere. These are bugs, in the simplest term, that cohabit inside our body.
Yeah, I've heard things that, you know, they make up most of the weight of our body. I mean, this is a lot.
Absolutely. So if you think about it, there are like 1,000 bacterial species in our gut, which amounts to about 200,000 genes, just bacterial genes. And if you have to compare it to the human genes, we only have, as human genes, we only have about 20,000 genes. So bacteria is everywhere. There are trillions of bacteria in our body. And they really govern how our biology works. So think about, I use this example all the time. It's an analogy. Like, you know, if you're looking at New York City, it's such a busy city. It's a bustling city with lots of people going everywhere, doing things. And if you microscopically, if you look at New York City from top, that's your microbiome. there's a lot of diversity, different types of bacteria, fungi, and viruses that live in our body.
Right. And one thing that I know is, let me ask you, what determines which species of all these millions of different microorganisms? And of course, they can also work together to create things like little cities, depending on the species that is there, what other raw materials might be there. They build things that might be considered sort of a plaque. It's called a biofilm. Mm-hmm. What determines which organisms are in each person? Because does everyone have the same, or do they depend on genetics, or does it have to do with what you eat? Like, what determines who lives there in your house, meaning your body?
That's a great question. So there is a commensal, like, so I will explain what commensal is. Everybody, commensal bacteria are healthy bacteria that everybody should have in their body. However, a lot of environmental factors are diet, physical activity, stress. All of this affects or changes the bacteria in our gut. To give you an example, like if you have a bad diet, you're eating a lot of saturated fats and, you know, high sugars, less prebiotic food, which is like high in fiber, it's going to change the bacterial composition in your gut. And that leads to production. So there is a downstream signaling that happens. So if there is a change in bacteria, that will change the metabolites that the bacteria produces. And if you have, just in a simple word, bad bacteria growing in your gut, they're going to produce bad metabolites. And that's going to lead into inflammation, chronic inflammation, IBD, you know, Crohn's, colitis. That's how it happens. So there are a lot of environmental factors that come into play that change our gut microbiome.
That is excellent. We're going to take just a little break right here so that you can listen to the Natural Medicine Chest listeners. And when we come back, we are going to continue our fascinating discussion with Dr. Vidisha Mohad, a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. And we're talking about a lot of her unique and some original research that has to do with things related to you and your gut health. We will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss Sar sarsaparilla or Smilax officinalis.
Sar sarsaparilla is a tropical plant which grows in South America, Mexico, and Guatemala. Although most Americans are familiar with it as a flavor enhancer for root beer, it has also been used for its beneficial properties for hundreds of years by many different cultures. In Roman times, the young shoots were eaten, and the mature vines were worn as garlands at festivals of Bacchus. According to ancient Roman writings, Sar sarsaparilla originated when the beautiful maiden, Smilax, was turned into a shrub after her love was slighted by the young crocus.
Sar sarsaparilla was brought to Europe in the 16th century by Spanish traders. A French physician, Nicolas Monardus, published a comprehensive account of Sar sarsaparilla as a treatment for syphilis in 1574. During Portuguese military operations in 1812, a British inspector general of hospitals noted its positive effect on syphilis patients. It has also been used in China for treatment of the same condition. Sar sarsaparilla was included in the United States Pharmacopoeia until 1950 as a recommended treatment of secondary syphilis.
Sar sarsaparilla's medicinal action appears to be a result of binding bacterial endotoxins in the gut, thereby decreasing their absorption. This greatly reduces the stress on the liver and is likely responsible for its historic use as a tonic and blood purifier.
In a controlled study of 92 patients published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1942, a chemically active component of Sar sarsaparilla, called sarsaparin, greatly improved psoriasis in 62% of the patients and resulted in complete clearance in 18%. Sar sarsaparilla is often recommended by naturopathic physicians for gout, arthritis, and psoriasis. Another folkloric use for Sar sarsaparilla is as a tonic for male sexual potency.
So, if you want a root beer flavored tea with a long history as a healthy tonic, reach for the Sauce Sarsaparilla in your natural medicine chest.
And welcome back to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Please visit our website at naturalnurse.com. Right on the bottom, you can sign up to be on our mailing list. And if you go to calendar, you will see all of our up-and-coming classes, workshops, many of which are free. We have the up-and-coming discussion about iron. That's a free one. And just join us or send us your comments, what you like, what you don't like. And, of course, you can always listen to many of our radio shows as well at naturalnurse.com media radio and also right here on prn.fm. So we're talking today with Dr. Vidisha Mohad, and she is a PhD postdoctoral fellow at Harvard Medical School. And we're talking about her research. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ellen.
So you shared about the fact that, you know, the gut microbiome is extremely important, and we're going to go into that more deeply. Thank you for your explanation so far. It was very clear, even if people aren't really aware of that term is. Let me ask you this. In terms of gastroenterology, I know you're not a treating physician. Mm-hmm. I know you're aware. Why is it? Or how is it, and I will say, so you don't have to say this, but to me, it's criminal that when people go see a gastroenterologist for either a new or long-term problem with stomach pain and, you know, all the different things that go along with it, gastritis, such as inflammation of the gut, there is no discussion of food. They are not even asked to fill out a diet diary. How is that possible?
So, I mean, like you said, I can't really talk about what the clinical practice is, but I think diet plays a major role, and more awareness has been, you know, people are getting more aware of this, the fact that, you know, diet impacts the microbiome and how microbiome impacts, you know, will impact, you know, how a person responds to a particular drug or treatment for that matter. So, given the, you know, reduced cost in high throughput sequencing and microbiome analysis, I think in the future, I do predict that taking into consideration person's microbiome composition is going to be a big part of how therapy is going to be designed for patients.
Yes, I love a term that you shared with me in the past, which I think is going to be an up-and-coming term. And I don't know if you develop it, but I never heard of it before, and it's called precision medicine.
Yes,
What do you mean by that?
I did not develop the word. It's a term. Precision medicine is basically something that is tailored for you. It's precise for you based on what your genetic composition is, microbiome composition is, right? For example, like when we, just to give you a simple example, like sometimes you take a painkiller, and it works for you, but it doesn't work for your friend or for your family member, right? It's the same drug, but because you're a different person, you have different genetic composition, that's why the drug isn't working for you. So we need to really understand this interaction between how the bacteria, or I'm just going to use the term microbiome, impacts how the drug works in your system versus to someone else, right? That's where microbiome comes into picture. And I think precision medicine is the future, where we will take into account each individual and their biological individuality into determining their treatment.
So to me, that makes a lot of sense because you have the evidence to back up the fact that this would be a wonderful way to individualize treatment protocols. And it seems to me over the many years I've been doing this, which is over 50 years, by the way, that the thing that seems to block this information from getting through is the fact that when you're talking about perhaps we should start with diet rather than perhaps we should start with a pharmaceutical, does that threaten pharmaceutical sales?
Well, I mean, the recommendation that comes to the patient comes directly from the doctor, right? So doctor has to take into account the patient's medical history, other comorbidities that the patient have. But I think it's not like, again, just I'm not a clinician, so I can't make clinical comments. However, it's the simplest thing to change, right? If someone is eating bad, why not eat healthy, more prebiotic, probiotic food and high fiber diet to see if that makes any change?
I think that would be the way to go. You know, how we prioritize interventions, I am a PhD RN. We do not at all discount the validity and the need for pharmaceutical drugs and surgery. They absolutely are part of the compendium of possible therapeutics. It just seems like we should use first things that are much safer with the lowest adverse effect possible, something the person can do on their own that's going to not only address whatever symptomatology brought them in, but also improve their overall health. So we usually go with lifestyle first, like you're saying, look at the diet and change it. Then we'll talk about interventions that are actually have a much better adverse effect profile, such as botanicals and herbs, and possibly homeopathics, which I know are still widely used in India and England, although not so much in the United States. And then if all else fails, yes, bring in the pharmaceuticals. But what they seem to do here, you go in with some kind of GI complaint, and the first thing you're given is Prilosec or, some kind of drug intervention that does not stop the cause of the problem.
I agree with you. And I always tell people it's funny to me when people, will complain that, they're having gut issues. Like I'm talking about my friends or family members. They're eating all the bad stuff, but they want to compensate the pleasure of eating bad stuff by taking probiotics. And it's not going to help.
I love this discussion. We're going to go into this. I love this discussion because
food. If you take probiotics, it's not doing anything. You're wasting money. First of all, probiotics are not cheap. Yes, you can eat yogurt. That's the cheapest form of probiotics. But taking pills is not going to help if you're not going to work on your diet, for sure.
That is excellent information. And I really think it's only in the last, not a long time, maybe only 5 years, that somehow the term probiotics, is widely on television commercials and people can be eating all junk food and then they think they have to pop a probiotic and it's going to help. And like you're saying, that is not the way to go. As a matter of fact, there was a yogurt commercial on TV promoted by a very, very big star, and they got zapped in the tune of millions of dollars for making claims that were unsubstantiated about, just eat this yogurt and everything will be fine.
Yeah, I mean, in order for probiotics to work, to give you a little bit more background on how it actually works. So if somebody is sick, has an infection, right, you give them antibiotics, rightfully so, they need to treat the infection, that's the cause of it. In that case, the antibiotics will wipe down all the bacteria in your gut. And now in that particular patient or person, giving probiotics will definitely help because that will help the commensal bacteria to grow, right? Because everything has been wiped out. But compared to someone else who is young, eating bad food, not being physically active and just popping probiotics, that probiotic is not going to do anything. It's not going to fix the dysbiosis that's going on in your gut.
So when you say a good diet, let's talk about what that means from your research, and also that might not be exactly the same for everyone.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, again, I'm not expert in, I'm not a dietitian, but I will, through my research and my readings and my experience, I would say food high in fiber, prebiotic food. The reason for that is, prebiotic food, low sugar, saturated fats, you want to limit that. The reason for that is when you eat high fiber food, it produces short chain fatty acids. That's a metabolite. It's just a byproduct that is produced. And that fiber food, the high fiber food allows to grow the commensal bacteria, which is good for you. The reason for that being more of a fiber high fiber food you eat, more short chain fatty acids are produced, and you know that will regulate your gut health. If you don't have fiber in your food, the commensal the bacteria that produces the short chain fatty acid is not going to develop. It's related to, you know, maintaining the pH of your gut, you know, how acidic the environment is, if the bacteria is going to survive or not survive because of, you know, the environment in your gut. So
now, something that your research has really gone into, when you're talking about the microbiome also, and you're looking at the gut health and integrity, tell us what leaky gut syndrome means to you. I know that's like a common term.
Yes.
But how would you interpret that as a scientist?
So leaky gut, I think it's a right term, whoever coined it. It explains that we use the term gut barrier dysfunction. So let me take a step back and explain what it means. So your gut is lined with cells, and these are epithelial cells, and they're tightly bound with each other. That's it. They're supposed to be bound to each other tightly so that whatever we eat or drink, the food is in direct contact with the epithelial cells, right? And it's lined with mucin, like mucus, and bacteria. Everything is on top of that epithelial layer. Now, if there is some sort of bacteria or some sort of food that you're eating that's going to impact this barrier that you have, and the barrier is going to get loose, the bacteria is going to seep down in through the epithelial cells inside your system. That's going to lead to production of cytokines. Let me explain it in a better way. Production of factors that leads to inflammation. So now the barrier is broken. It's open gateway, right? Bacteria can go in and out, whatever you're eating. And that's going to lead to inflammation. Chronic inflammation will happen over a period of time if nothing is done about fixing that barrier. So what we do in the lab, and that's where the intestinal alkaline phosphatase enzyme comes into play, is this particular enzyme helps to build this barrier back. And that's what we're working on. We're trying to develop this enzyme into an oral formulation that can be taken. And because it's naturally produced by the body, it's not a pharmaceutical, it's not a drug that we're developing, right? It's something that our body produces, but with age and with diseases, the amount of the production of this enzyme goes down. Was I clear enough?
Yeah, that is. And of course, another way, what I have always found, because I've been doing this for many years, is that many people in the scientific community have rejected the term leaky gut, even though you said, wow, that is a good explanation about what's going on. And I've been at any number of pharmacy colleges where I lecture about herb-drug interactions, as well as medical schools where I teach residents how to consider integrating natural therapeutics into their analysis and protocol decisions, which of course leads to something more like precision medicine. And when I use the term leaky gut, we get blowback, we get arms crossed, but if I just switch over to the term intestinal permeability, that opens up the world of understanding.
I think leaky gut is very, when you know, it's my, in my experience, when you're around scientists and you're around doctors, you know, using scientific terms is what they prefer. But if I had to explain this to my mom, she would understand it better if I said leaky gut than if I said, you know, permeability. Like, she wouldn't understand what I'm talking about. But I think it's important to dumbing down is not the right word, but like, you know, explain it to the level that people can understand, people with no scientific background can understand.
Yeah, but it really is the same thing. Now, yeah. one of the pushbacks about doing that, even what you're talking about for a physician, once your work gets into a place where it can be used as a clinical decision making, is the amount of time that takes versus just writing a script for an antacid or, you know, some other anti-inflammatory. I mean, the amount of time it takes to explain eating decisions and using something like you're talking about, how can we allow physicians to have more time to consider something like precision medicine?
Precision medicine, like I said, it's up and coming. It's going to be the new era of medicine, I think. But again, this is a systemic problem, right? It will take some time for this for precision medicine to become a norm, but I think I have faith. And I, given the evidence that we have, we cannot undermine the importance of person's individuality in terms of the microbiome and genetic composition. And moving forward, I think that will have to be taken into consideration before running any clinical trials or doing any prescriptions or anything like that, or to determine what is right for one particular patient. And once the system is developed, I think it will be easier. Right now, I totally understand, you know, the doctor has 2 minutes to see the patient, so they go and write a script. I'm not saying that's correct, but...
Actually, it is close to that. The correct amount is 8 minutes. And by the time they walk in and try to find the code for billing in the computer, the 8 minutes is pretty much up. I mean, it's a shame.
And people don't know how to ask the, they're not aware of all the questions that needs to be asked. So I think that's where you come into picture, Ellen, that you are educating the public with the options and, you know, alternatives, and giving them the resources for what evidence-based practice should be, right? So you're doing a great job at that.
Now, how do people, if people are curious after today's show, or of course, like you said, even in modern culture, there's this big push of just everybody should take tons of, you know, expensive probiotic pills, which I don't support either. How would somebody find out what is up with their personal microbiome? Because you explained that it can be individual, both through, you know, what you're born with and what you eat and genetic factors.
Right. So microbiome analysis is done through looking at your stool. So in a research setting, like I'm very familiar with the research setting. So what we do is we collect stools from patients with different, you know, collect stools from healthy patients, IBD, patients with, you know, metabolic disorders. And we run a sequencing analysis on the stool. And when you run the sequencing analysis, you get a whole global picture. It tells you exactly each and every bacteria that is present in that particular person's body. I'm just using humans as an example here. We do mice studies and a lot of different animal models. But when you do this sequencing, which is called 16S sequencing, it's a ribosome sequencing. I won't go into too much detail about what it is, but it will tell you exactly A to Z what is your microbiome composition. So right now, in a research setting, it's very easy for us to do that. But clinically, I don't know if it's out there. There are a couple of startups that I have in Boston that are doing this microbiome analysis, where they send you a kit at home and you just take your stool sample and you send the kit back. Again, I'm not supporting anything, any company or anything like that, just as a disclosure. I'm aware of the fact that people are doing their microbiome analysis just to get an understanding of what their composition is.
Absolutely. Even 30 years ago, we were using that, and I'm sure it's nowhere as sophisticated. It was called a comprehensive digestive stool analysis. And when we got back the results clinically, now, this was done at a holistic physician's office, big office in Manhattan, where I was the head nurse for 23 years. And we used all the latest things. But people had to pay for that test out of their pocket. There was no way to get it covered by health insurance. And I think that might still be the case.
Yes, I think so, too. Yes, this is out of pocket. You have to pay for the service if you sign up for getting your microbiome analysis. Yes, absolutely. I don't think
so. Then once you know that, though, so even the ones that you're doing from a research perspective, so then you see what that individual might have that could lead to some of their symptomatology.
Mm-hmm.
And then what would be a next step?
So the next step is to, so let's say if you took a stool sample from someone, let's say what a good example would be.
Well, you know what, you can think about that. And what we'll do is we'll take our next break here so that our listeners could know more about Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. And when we come back, we will continue our fascinating discussion with Dr. Vidisha Mohan, PhD, fellow at Harvard Medical School, and the latest research that she is doing, which is really phenomenal and can change the course of patient treatment to something much more logical and much more precise. over time. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And welcome back to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Check out our website at naturalnurse.com, where you can email us with your questions and comments. Visit calendar to see our list of up and coming classes. Join our mailing list just by putting your email and nothing else in the bottom left-hand corner on the front of naturalnurse.com. Today we are here with our guest, Dr. Vidisha Mohad, PhD from Harvard Medical School, and she is a researcher. She's pointed out many times over that you are not the kind of doctor you go and ask questions to for your health. And you've been very, very clear about that, Vidisha. But your knowledge of the research that will lead to different changes in patient intervention, I think, are very, very important.
Thank you, Ellen. I'm very excited about the research that we do, and I hope we make a difference in, you know, improving patients' quality of life. That's the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal of research is translational. There is no point doing work in the lab which is not going to be translational and, you know, improve patients' life. So.
But there's sort of a walkthrough process. Like, you're doing the research, you're proving time and time again, not only you, but researchers for many, many decades have been proving the importance of the gut microbiome and how to create a healthier microbiome. But your research is really a lot deeper than some of your predecessors, which makes sense because, you know, you pick up where they left off and you're younger and you have newer techniques and laboratories available to you. With you, it's like the highest in the world, which is fantastic, so that you can do some very precise analysis. So if someone were to get their microbiome tested by their doctor, you know, and then, of course, unfortunately, right now, that's only available to people who could afford to pay for it because it's not covered by insurance. And then they could change their diet and see if that changes the microbiome picture. And, in fact, see if it helps any of their symptoms as well. And there's no adverse effect to trying that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, like I said, in our gut, we have commensal bacteria. These are like, you know, regular bacteria that are always there that are good for you. And so when we do this analysis, the microbiome analysis, you'll get an understanding of whether the, I'm just going to use the word good and bad so it's easy for people to understand, whether the good bacteria is lower or the bad bacteria is high. So then you can try to eat food which have evidence. And people have done research showing that, okay, if you eat this particular food, that is going to increase, let's say, the lactobacillus or like the bacteria DTs in your gut, which are good bacteria. That's the great thing to do. What I want to specifically do, and I can't go into too much detail because of disclosing research from the lab, but what my goal is to taking. Understanding the microbiome from, let's say, IBD or diabetes or like any other inflammation disorder, you take that, you understand the microbiome, you implant that particular microbiome in a germ-free mice. So this is the model, which is absolutely amazing. Like, it's revolutionary. The germ-free mice are mice which have no, they're clean of microbiome. They have no bugs in their system. So you take the stool or the bacteria from a disease model and you transplant that in the germ-free mice, and you see what happens when you do that in the germ-free mice and you induce, let's say, colitis in that animal and see whether the good bacteria is able to rescue that the leaky gut syndrome that you see in colitis, right? And if that's the case, then we need to work towards, and my goal is to work towards developing therapeutics. Whether it be through the process of IAP or developing specific bugs that could be orally taken to help improve the commensal and improve the symptoms of the disease.
As well as, like you said, doing something very simple, such as changing your diet and making that part of the medical intervention in a very serious way. Not just how a lot of doctors go, well, eat healthy. But, you know, a little bit more specific, like we do in functional and holistic medicine, along with a wide variety of herbs, particularly mucilaginous herbs that are known to actually not only coat that irritated gastrointestinal mucosa, but allow healthier microorganisms to grow naturally. by supplying those nutrients that they may need. So that's another next step, which is something that perhaps you can even test in the lab, because those herbs have a very low incident of adverse effects and yet a very high level of efficacy and a huge amount of traditional use. Certainly look to your country with Ayurvedic medicine, for instance.
Absolutely. I would be very interested. We should talk about this, the herbs that you're talking about, to see, you know, if I can incorporate that, a study or design a small study to test it out.
Well, let's do that. We'll do that between you and I, and then we'll have a show about it next year. Yes. Even if you say, well, it didn't do much, I would still do a show about it because I'm very interested.
About that. I have like so many ideas, but there's only so much I can do. But absolutely, I would love to, you know, discuss this further and, you know, maybe do a small study. Talking
now,
about
final, we only have a few more minutes.
All right,
Dr. Mohead. So I just want to throw this out. What are your thoughts on COVID?
Oh, COVID. Oh my God, pandemic.
We only have a few minutes, so tell
yes.
us.
So all I can say is I'm really excited about the vaccine. I think people need to get vaccinated. That's all I can say. It's a very immunogenic, efficacious vaccine, and it's been developed in 7 months, which traditionally takes about 20 years. And in order for us to get back to our normal life, which is going to be like, it's going to take another year or so to develop herd immunity. But I think this vaccine is very effective. Everybody needs to get vaccinated so that we can, you know, get over this pandemic life.
So you're feeling that it is positive, even though it was done so quickly?
Yes. The thing is, it's an mRNA vaccine. It's very different from traditional, like, you know, where they use adenovector and attenuated version of the virus. mRNA, it's a newer technology. I have looked at the data myself, and, you know, I have listened to people who have done the research, and the efficacy is great for this vaccine. So I think in order to achieve herd immunity, we all have to get vaccinated.
Well, thank you for, you know, sharing your scientific perspective on that and for all the work that you're doing on bringing a really wonderful science-based understanding to something that we have focused on in functional medicine for so long, including gut barrier deficiencies such as leaky gut syndrome, the use of the proper kind of probiotics, which you're really moving forward with, not just taking it on top of a lot of junk food, and for all of your fantastic work. I really want to thank you for your focus on that.
Thank you so much, and it was lovely talking to you, and I'm so honored to be on your show. But on a side note, let's talk about your ideas on the herbal medicine. I'm very curious.
Yes, we definitely will. And a good place for our listeners to find you, I would say, is go to PubMed and put in your name, Vidisha Mohead, and all these studies you have been involved with will pop up. So they can actually look at your research.
They can also find me on LinkedIn and my email. I have given you my email, so feel free to reach out. I'm just talking to the audience with any questions or anything I can help out with.
Thank you.
Happy to talk to young girls who are interested in science for any mentorship, putting it out there. We'd be happy to mentor people.
That is very important, and thank you for throwing that out to our listening audience. And thank you so much for listening once again right here on Progressive Radio Network to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And until next time, this is Ellen Kamine, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.